for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. When President-elect Obama takes office 35 days from now, he becomes the first president with enormous grassroots support and the technical means to keep these supporters engaged. Joining me in the studio to talk about the role these internet armies may play in the Obama administration, Patricia McGinnis. She's CEO of the Council for Excellence in Government. Corinne Hegland, she's a reporter for the National Journal. Joining us from Palo Alto, California, is Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Stanford University. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Corinne, if I could start with you. Describe the internet army that President-elect Obama seemed to put together during his campaign.
The internet army that Obama pulled together wasn't just internet. It was actually a very old school approach to running a campaign, which is asking people to go out, knock on doors, and talk to their neighbors. What he did was take that grassroots approach and do it both physically in very real communities around the U.S. that have never seen a Democratic ground campaign before, and virtually over the internet. So in pulling people together virtually, he applied them to neighbor-to-neighbor tasks in much the same way that old-style campaigns used to do.
So how critical do you think that was to his campaign?
Oh, it was amazingly critical. I spoke to a retired nurse, Millie Hoffer, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, who said that she had always wanted to get more involved, but nobody ever asked me, she said. So this was the first time that people were asked to get involved. And those invitations came from friends over the internet, as well as from local county.
People knocking at the door and that sort of thing.
Exactly. And in doing that, he was able to mobilize this amazing army.
Lawrence Lessig, what would you say the internet offered in the way of extraordinary opportunities to the Obama campaign?
Well, I think there are two things here. First, it's important that we not think that this was all a matter of technology. I mean, one of the most important parts of this campaign was that it was a candidate who had a vision and a message which resonated, which was authentic, which got people excited. So if it weren't for that, we wouldn't be talking about the Obama revolution. Now, what the technology did was to give people the power to engage in a way that turned them from mere sort of couch potato recipients of, you know, campaign propaganda into people who could actually participate in spreading the word and making their own voice, in acting in ways that made them feel more like soldiers rather than recipients. And I think it's that activity, it's that line, which actually the Dean campaign taught us how originally to do, that turned an enormous number of people into active campaigners rather than just mere supporters.
Patricia McGinnis, as someone who's involved in seeing government ways improve, you must have been pleased to see this.
Absolutely. This combination of high tech and high touch is exactly what's been described, and it is what happened. I would add that one of the dimensions of the campaign that was so pleasing to us was the engagement of young people who received text messages, you know, in the moment, giving them news at the same time the National Journal reporters got the news, and again, requesting action and providing opportunities to actually go and do things physically. So I think this, if this can be translated into government, this is a very good thing. This is a vision that we've had for some time, and it has not yet been realized.
Well, and of course, that's the major challenge at this point, to see what this activity that's gone on during the campaign, how it can be translated into the ongoing work of government.
I think that translating it from the campaign now to the transition, and if you go to the transition website, you still feel the interactivity. People are being asked for their views, being asked for their priorities, being asked to hold house parties about health care. So it's there. When the move occurs to government, I think that some additional barriers are going to be there. This is going to be a lot harder in government than it was in the campaign and even in the transition because of the issues around security, privacy, the vast number of federal regulations regarding the internet, surveying customers and reaching out to the public, and even probably more difficult, the cultural barriers that have kept government from sharing information as collaboratively as they should. So this is going to be a whole new ballgame in government.
Patricia McGinnis, she's CEO of the Council for Excellence in Government. Corinne Hegland is a reporter for the National Journal. Lawrence Lessig is professor of law at Stanford University. His recent books include Free Culture, How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I do want to go further into those cultural barriers that Patricia mentioned, Corinne, but at the same time, having watched this kind of networking during the campaign itself, what do you see going on during the transition?
I see a lot of attention being paid to what's happening in Washington with the transition and the website for people speaking to communicate directly with the White House. And there is a difficulty with that insofar as it's hard for 13 million people to tell government what they think. On the other hand, the House parties for change, the Change is Coming parties this last weekend, and the Obama campaign field organizers and volunteers have all remained in contact with each other and have been talking about how to go forward. And what they're looking at is a relatively decentralized. Mm. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. They're still sorting out a lot of questions. But providing paid staff support to communities organizing not just around Obama's legislative agenda, but also around state and local initiatives. And the importance of this is 13 million people can't tell the White House what to do. But 13 million people working through their local communities, through virtual communities, can identify problems among themselves and forward the best input forward, and the White House can work with that.
Did you attend one of those House parties?
I did not, unfortunately. I had friends and sources who were at them. In Washington, D.C., there was an enormous, I think 180 people, according to the email that I saw, in which they talked about memories from the campaign and then talked about what they wanted to do going forward. What are the local projects they'd like to take on? And what else could they do? Can they teach the skills they learned during this campaign to others? Can they put those community organizing skills to work here in Washington?
Larry Lessig, how do you react to those 10,000 house parties that took place?
Well, I think they are extremely important in continuing, as was described, in continuing this energy. I think the hardest challenge now is to integrate that energy into the existing process for governance. So, of course, Obama gets elected by making an appeal to the people, which translates into enough votes to beat the other side, but now he needs to make an appeal to members of Congress in the ordinary political process to get his legislation enacted into law. And so the challenge will be how to take this enormous energy and begin to channel it back into the process of lawmaking so that the fundamental reforms he's been talking about can actually be effective.
What about the cultural barriers you talked about, Patricia?
Well, we've seen in government that most of the issues that are challenges now cross the boundaries of organizations in government. Many agencies, many departments are involved in the economic crisis or in national and homeland security or healthcare. So there are barriers in terms of the way money flows, the way decisions are made, the way the reporting relationships work that keep people in agencies from working in the kinds of networks that we saw in the campaign. And that's really what's needed to get the results that we're looking for. I think that this leadership is an opportunity to improve and eliminate some of those cultural barriers simply through leadership. And by that I mean the president and the top leaders that he is choosing by example and by expectation need to make it clear that the goals around these big issues are goals that will be shared goals, and progress and results will be measured. And the expectation will be that people are involved in the decision-making.
Patricia McGinnis, the Council for Excellence in Government. Do join us, 800-433-8850. We'll get into some of the particulars when we come back. And we are back talking about the use of technology, the use of the extraordinary organization that the Obama campaign was able to form during the campaign, and to what extent it will be used throughout the Obama presidency. Here's an email from Kurt, who says, I was assigned to photograph one of the local Obama meeting house parties in Cincinnati. It was an extremely diverse group crossing all ages and cultures. They, and now I, have high hopes that this grassroots participation will continue throughout Obama's term in office. This could be a whole new and democratic way of managing government that truly realizes the voices of all individuals in their own communities. It was very encouraging. Is that too optimistic a view, Patricia?
I hope not. I think this is a great opportunity, and people are energized and they are hopeful. So The question is, can this be structured in a way that it does have an impact, that these voices are heard in a systematic way?
So would you see these kinds of gatherings, Corrine, taking place around particular issues as opposed to simply coming together as fundraisers, as potluck suppers, what have you?
Absolutely. I think a lot of the structure and focus of these gatherings going forward is still to be determined. But based on what happened during the campaign and based on what I have heard from people who were involved at the local and state regional levels, they're interested in working on particular issues. So in some areas, it may well be urban planning. It may be unemployment in the region and jobs. It may be, I mean, Washington dollars don't just get spent in Washington. They mostly get spent in states and local areas. And so these gatherings of people can work on these issues in their area and connect it back up to Washington.
Larry, do you see that happening?
Yeah, I do. But again, I think the big problem, the big challenge is not to create expectations that are going to be too hard to meet, because all of these people, of course, are excited and engaged in the process of changing government. But the process of actually governing is much slower and more compromised than I think many people recognize. And so the real challenge for Obama, I think, is to focus on what the real image is, what the real program is that continues to engage these people in fundamental change, without letting the story get bogged down in the details of what the negotiations are going to be over the first major legislation that he tries to introduce.
Patricia, do you see these groups becoming new and more effective political organizing groups around particular issues?
Well, I think the importance is that they are at the grassroots level of what should be a connected network, from people organized either around an issue or around a community and setting priorities. I think you could organize these in a number of ways. And if the connections are there with other nonprofit organizations, with local and state government, and with the federal government, then things can happen. But the question is how to synthesize and get these messages to the decision makers at the right time. And there are a lot of good ideas in the community, and there may be solutions that will come simply from bringing people together and talking about that. How do we make sure that our member of Congress, you know, our mayor, hears our message, and that we hold that person accountable for making some actual change? I think this whole issue has many dimensions. I mean, the first one is transparency, and we've heard a lot about that in the campaign, and this has really been something that Senator Obama played a leadership role in. People would like to have information in a way that they can actually use it to do something. If you look at government websites, there has been tremendous improvement in the last few years, believe me, but it's still not at the point where it's really useful to a person who doesn't understand the bureaucracy in the organization. And then there is engaging the public and bringing those messages, I would say particularly to members of Congress. And there, I think you do have to accompany the House parties with some good in-depth survey research that where you know that the answers are representative of a community, a state, even the country.
Is there money involved at these House parties? I realize how crass a question that might be, but are these House parties used as a fundraising mechanism now that the campaign is over?
I do not know. So let me sidestep that question entirely and answer another one that is related,
all right,
which is that there is interest among the Obama volunteers and the Obama campaign organization to continue that organization somehow going forward with funding. And one very strong idea floating about is to continue to provide paid staff support. So phone calls went out to some of the field organizers last week. Would you possibly be interested in coming back to work? Not for Obama's reelection, but for, you know, what you started, helping local communities, helping helping people organize. And how to fund that has not been determined, to the best of my knowledge. Whether that is indeed what they are going to do has not been determined, but the calls went out.
You know, it's interesting that one of the huge complaints about government has been that it's only the big lobbyists who have access to members of Congress. Do you see this as a mechanism for having a greater impact on what happens in Congress, Corrine?
I do. And can I jump back in American history about 150 years for a moment? There is a wonderful Harvard professor named Theda Skocpol who has been documenting the roots of American social policy for the last 15 years or so. And what she has found is that the historic method of organizational change, of community change in America, is federated associations that are driven by membership, not driven by Washington, that are mimic the structure of the U.S. government in the sense of having local chapters and state chapters and national chapters, but are not part of government. And it is these federated membership associations that manage to get, for example, needy mothers, needy widows' pensions, well before women had the right to vote. Women's groups managed to get a federal children's bureau before they had the right to vote. The American Legion lobbied, drafted, and helped implement the GI Bill. Labor, as has been well documented, helped President Roosevelt push through the New Deal. So it's this sort of federated association is a very powerful mechanism of organizing and passing along change in American life. It fell out of service in the 1960s for some fairly good reasons. Young people stopped joining the old associations, which were often racist, sexist, and dependent on the ample volunteer time of women who couldn't work outside the home. But the new groups that the young people started tended to be focused on Washington, which makes sense. If you want to change things, go to Washington. You can do it faster there. But if you want to change Washington, what the old federated associations that Dr. Skocpol documented did and what the Obama campaign did, say if you want to change Washington, go knock next door.
Now, go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, so that's hopeful, and I hope that turns out to be right. But I think one of the biggest problems the administration is going to face is that the next election cycle begins very soon.
If it hasn't already begun.
Yeah, certainly at Congress it's already begun. And so, again, to the extent that the job is passing bills through Congress, there's an enormous amount of influence that's got to be leveraged to make sure that Congress continues to support this administration. And so long as we've got private funding of public elections, so long as $2,300 bundled contributions continue to be most significant, not so much at the presidency level, as Obama has taught us, but very significantly at the level of Congress and the Senate, all of these voices of people and their, you know, small-town meetups around Obama are going to be outweighed by the extraordinary importance and power of people who are going to be able to raise that large amount of money to control Congress. So in one sense, unless Obama puts changing this economy of influence right at the center of his revolution, all of these federated people working in local elections are going to be drowned out very quickly by the power of money in Washington.
Larry, I'm also interested in the legal constraints that could be put on these groups once a president-elect takes office.
Well, they do face very significant complexities because of the way rules regulating political participation by groups have been developed. And I think that the ownership of the group and what it does is going to be a challenge. I know the Obama administration faced this already. They have a nonprofit that was set up to facilitate the transition, change.gov. And originally, you know, the question was, well, what about the assets that nonprofit owns, for example, like the copyrights? And originally the site said all rights reserved, and then recently the site has changed itself to say that basically all of these assets are licensed to the public freely. That change was an important signal of good faith, I think, by the administration, but it also was a signal of just how complicated this process is going to be.
Well, Could the Obama administration itself, Patricia McGinnis, set up a nonprofit organization that could continue to operate during his term in office?
Well, if you look at government structure, there are nonprofit organizations that have been funded or endowed by congressional appropriations, with federal funds. So I think that something like that would be possible. But drawing the line between the work of government and campaigning for reelection, that's a bright line that will get a lot of attention.
Right.
There is some gray area here that really does have to be clarified. I think this is not just about organizing to get a set agenda passed. It should also be viewed as enabling the public, either as individuals or in groups, to help shape the priorities, to help provide insights about the problems that need to be solved, and to keep the design of the programs and the execution real. We've seen a lot of well-intentioned programs that once they were passed and implemented, there were so many problems that you literally had to go back to the drawing board.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Josh. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I am calling. I was a part of this Obama movement and a part of the campaign and did some work there. And I guess I think that it's very important that we don't classify this grassroots movement as Obama's people putting forward Obama's agenda, that we keep this as much as possible or maybe move it more towards a real democracy where Obama is our man and he pushes forward our agenda. I agree greatly that these supporters, myself included, have positions on issues that, you know, that's why we put Obama in office, and that he needs to keep his promises or we need to activate in a new direction, that we need to make sure that these issues are pushed forward in the way that we were told they're going to be.
Very interesting. Corrine, do you want to comment?
I'm jumping back and forth between the two aspects of that. I agree wholeheartedly with both, but on the one hand, yes, this cannot be top-down. The campaign did not. What made the campaign work, Obama set the tone, and he was the candidate who lit this kindling on fire. But that kindling was waiting to be lit. People were already organizing. Youth were getting more engaged in communities, in political activism, in virtual activism, as has been documented by the Putnam Project on Civic Engagement at Harvard. Well before Obama came along. So he provided the tone and was the candidate, but this was happening without him. And what made it really powerful was the person-to-person component of it. It wasn't what people told Obama. It was what they told their neighbors, whether virtual or physical. And so in order for this to continue, it can't possibly be emails from Obama saying, hey, I'm trying to pass this bill. Go tell your congressman to vote for it.
Right.
That would entirely fizzle.
Right.
On the other hand, nobody wants that to happen anyway. So how to push it forward means that local groups have to, local communities, local volunteers, the local movements have to find what they're passionate about and have to work for it. And that means they will agree with Obama sometimes and they will disagree with Obama sometimes.
Patricia.
During the campaign, the desired result was very clear, to generate enough votes to win. That was a metric that is sort of indisputable. Now that we are moving toward governing, the desired result is not so clear. For example, in healthcare, we know that we need to reform the system. We know that the cost is rising too fast, and it's a problem even for the insured. We know that people feel that they don't have enough information. We know that the providers aren't connected in terms of being able to share information through electronic health records. There are lots of issues, but we need to define the bright line, the result, with the help of the people. Much
and
more complicated.
We'll take just a short break here. We'll talk more about definitions when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, featuring the relaunch of its website, germany.info, with a new design and interactive features, online at germany.info. By WAMU's The Conversation, with listener-generated discussions and a monthly online chat with Diane Rehm. More information at conversation.wamu.org. And by the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet W.S. Merwin reads poems about memory and mortality from his new collection, The Shadow of Sirius. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we'll go right back to the phones, this time to someone who did attend one of those parties last night, to Jeannie in Mesa, Arizona. Good morning to you.
Hi, this is Jeannie. We did attend, and if you look on the website, you can see what the agenda was and even the videos that, you know, Obama sends out to us. We had an agenda that, you know, asking us what our priorities were, and we came up for Arizona was energy. And then it asked us, or he asked us, to find a group that we could do something in until there's something else to do. And we did that. There was 20-year-olds to 85-year-olds at this group, and we have all decided to work on home rehabilitation.
Huh.
And, yeah, it's a very pointed agenda. And many of us are also involved with MoveOn.org, and on January 11th, they're having a party on how to access government. So we're watching his back, and we're watching him, because if he goes away, I mean, we aren't his, you know, groupies. If he goes away from what he promised us, we're going to get him.
That's interesting. Corrine?
I'm fascinated by how you got to home rehabilitation. I mean, that's just amazing, from energy to home rehabilitation.
Exactly.
Which is exactly the sort of connecting what happens at the federal and international level, for that matter, to what's happening not just in your community and now in your individual homes. That's a perfect...
Because he has asked us what's important. He is reflecting what we have been telling him for the last 2 years.
That's very interesting. Thanks for calling and sharing, Jeannie. Here's an email from Henry, who says there's an inherent conflict between idealizing an actual result. There's another conflict between campaigning and governing. The devotion, as I see it during the campaign, was to a person and not generally based on any particular idea. I was at one of the gatherings in Florida. I asked the question about health care and how the Obama plan will actually help the uninsured. Nobody could answer. How do we make sure that we do not develop a cult following and we get to the same attitude as Bush that says, if you don't support us, you must be against us? Another question I raised was, how was it that Obama won Florida and that does not translate to gains in the Florida House for Democrats? Larry, do you want to comment on the first part of that?
Sure. I think it's an important question. And that's why I think at least some are wondering whether it wouldn't make more sense to channel some of the energy around this movement to the really fundamental changes that Obama identified more in the early part of the campaign than later, the what he described as changing the way government works, which actually is an agenda that unites a wider range of people than the agenda, you know, that might be about a specific proposal around health care or a specific way to deal with the energy crisis or the global warming crisis. And in some ways, that broader agenda could actually be more bipartisan than the particular partisan fights that are going to develop as we get down to the nitty-gritty of fundamental reform. So the choice about whether to deploy to make sure health care gets passed versus deploy to make sure that this is a transformational presidency, I think is the hard question that the Obama team needs to decide. And I'm not sure what the right answer is.
Patricia.
I think Larry, I think you're right. You're exactly right. What was appealing about Obama in the campaign was not just his particular positions on various issues. Those sort of came as the campaign unfolded. But it was more the approach in the beginning, which was to value bipartisanship, to be sort of sick and tired of, you know, this sort of rancorous partisan debate argument that takes place in Washington, and to be willing to listen. And I think he said over and over, you know, this is your campaign. This is your government.
It's not about me. It's about you.
It's not about me. It's about you. And so figuring out how to make it about the people around the country, even those who did not vote for him, and even those who aren't part of organized groups, you know, I think is the real challenge. And it is going to require different ways of communicating, different ways of making policy, of implementing policy, and the separate branch of government, the Congress, is going to have to be brought into this new approach. And we, you know, so far haven't I think that's very unclear how that's going to work.
And then there's the privacy issue. Here's an email from Barbara, who says, all this talk about the Obama grassroots organization And what becomes of the massive database of email addresses and cell phone numbers reminds me of why, when I sent a contribution to the Obama campaign, I did it with a disposable email address. Not everyone who supported his campaign, whether with votes or dollars, did it to become part of an ongoing virtual community. My email address is mine, not Mr. Obama's, and certainly not the DNC's. I was not giving out any sort of permission to use it for any purpose whatsoever, except to confirm receipt of the donation. Obama's organization would do well to tread carefully before using that database in the future. Larry Lustig.
Yeah, well, I think that they do need to be careful, and I think that they are careful, and I think that the key is how simple it is to get out. And the campaign and the ongoing transition has been very good in facilitating a basic one click to get out of the community. But it's very hard right now, not just for Obama, but anybody, to understand what expectations are when you sign up for one of these contributions or one of these campaigns. And I think we all need to cut each other a little bit of slack as we try to come to terms with what those expectations should be.
All right. To Plantation, Florida. Aizan, thanks for waiting.
Hi, Darian. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
So interesting today.
Good.
I wanted to comment on the grassroots organization that the campaign ran on. It can be very effective in governing, but not from, you know, the top down, like Obama was saying, from the bottom up, because the better organized we are, the more change we can influence through our elected officials, Congress, the Senate. You know, we can influence these people because the more organized we are, the more influence we can have on them.
But in effect, that's precisely what the Obama team is after, is it not, Corrine?
I'm sorry, that
organizing to offer ideas and put pressure on the Congress is exactly what they're after.
Partially, I was struck by what the woman from Arizona said earlier, two comments she made. One, we are not Obama groupies. And two, that as part of the agenda for the House party this weekend, they were asked to not only identify an issue, but identify a group they could work with. And that's really important. Nothing is happening in a vacuum. Healthcare isn't just waiting a golden apple to be plucked. Groups have been organizing very hard around this at both local, state, and national levels. And in fact, within the last few years, a coalition has come together called Americans for Healthcare Now, which is designed to bridge the gap that often exists between Washington-focused campaigns and community-focused campaigns. Americans for Healthcare Now, which I've only looked at as an organization, I don't follow healthcare as a reporter, connects both the national advocacy groups and local community groups. And so by turning to who else is working on what you are interested in and what can you do with those people, and I think the Obama campaign gets it. So it's partially about Washington, but a lot of it isn't.
One thing that we learned, because we did look at healthcare from the bottom up, the Council for Excellence in Government in partnership with the National Academy of Sciences, and we did that with some extensive survey work in local communities and then on a national basis, and town hall meetings that were authentic town halls where we partnered with local media and invited everyone. And so the people who came were not those who necessarily represented an organization. We really had, we saw that people who came were people who had issues that they really wanted to talk about. So I think that figuring out how to bring those voices into the mix is just as important as providing ways for organized groups of people to connect and work on an agenda. The value of that, from my perspective, was that we found out that most people really didn't understand the healthcare proposals of either candidate. They had a lot of questions about the cost. How would it affect me? You know, what will it really mean for the uninsured? Can we afford this? Who's going to pay for it? You know, questions that weren't answered in their minds by the proposals they heard. So you can explore those issues systematically if you do it in a structured way with people who do represent the real grassroots where the problems exist.
Larry Lessig, would you see a great many more town hall meetings occurring across the country, sort of rising up out of these many, many house parties?
I certainly do, and that is only because I think that this campaign has changed the expectation of people about how politics functions. I mean, restores us to a much more participatory politics. It reminds me, I do a lot of work in the copyright areas, and, you know, we're seeing a revival of what you could think of as a read-write culture, culture where people participate in the culture. They're not just couch potatoes receiving culture. I think this is a kind of rise in read-write politics where we're going back to a time when people felt like politics was the sort of thing they needed to get out and participate in and talk about, whether in virtual town halls or real town halls. And to the extent that continues, we're going to see many more candidates recognizing that if they're not doing that, they're not doing politics.
On the campaign trail, Barack Obama said he would appoint his first chief technology officer. Larry, what do you see that might fall under this person's jurisdiction?
Well, I think it's one of the most important things he said about technology, second only to his commitment to network neutrality. But I think there's a big question about exactly what that looks like, because, first of all, the government has an enormous amount of work it needs to do to use technology in a smarter, more efficient, and participatory way. And any CTO could spend his or her whole life just dealing with that particular problem. But there's a whole range of other questions about exactly how technology could be better used to govern, to achieve the objectives of governance, to be smarter in the way in which we deploy technology, to avoid problems the government's trying to eliminate, such as in the context of global warming. And so that broader vision of the interaction between technology and government is also an enormously big task. And so we're going to depend on the kind of person he appoints, whether that person is the bigger vision or even just the more what we traditionally think of as a CIO function for government.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Patricia, to what extent do you think that what we're seeing may be an early but fundamental change in the way our democratic government operates?
Well, I do think that the internet is sort of, if you can draw an analogy to the printing press. I mean, think about what happened after materials could be printed. It changed, it transformed not just a government or one place, it really transformed the globe. And I think the internet has the same potential, and we really have only scratched the surface.
Larry, would you agree with that?
No, absolutely. I think, the difference between the Dean campaign and the Obama campaign were huge, but the Obama campaign couldn't have happened without Dean. And I think the next great successful round, whether that's 2012 or 2016, will be unrecognizable from the perspective we have today.
Unrecognizable. What does that mean,
well,
Patricia?
But I'm interested not just in campaigns, but
right.
in what this could mean for government
exactly.
and participatory democracy. So one thing I know we're running short on time, but the chief technology officer, for example, I think that person should be in the White House. I think that this is what we need is leadership as close to the center of government as possible. There is an army of CIOs and technology staff around government. There is in the Office of Management and management and budget, a technology office, a deputy director for management who focuses on technology. All of that should remain in place. But for this to be transformational, it has to be located at the center in terms of articulating the vision, a very ambitious vision, and then systematically working with not just the federal government, but down through state and local government, and in this case, the private sector, the nonprofit sector, to actually make dimensions of this vision a reality. People
and how
want to be engaged.
Do you think that is to be?
That this position will be located in the White House?
Right.
I'm going to say likely.
All right. That'll be the last word. Patricia McGinnis is CEO at the Council for Excellence in Government. Lawrence Lessig is professor of law at Stanford University. Corrine Hegland is a reporter for the National Journal. We'll be watching this very carefully. Very interesting discussion. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.